either we like it or not, consumers are going to talk about our brands. And that's where you have to understand that it's not your sharing custody. You have lost a lot of control of the content that is happening out there. So I think the best way for you to do that is, one, to recognize that. Two, to celebrate the fact that there are millions of consumers that are willing to talk about your brand. And I think the moment you embrace it, then you start creating value for the brand. I think the moment you try to control or you try to ignore, then it's when you get in trouble.
Not only is Anna Maria a badass, she was the global VP of marketing at Pepsi and now the CMO of consumer in the US at Microsoft. She's also just a super kind-hearted individual. I think you're really going to enjoy the show today. If you do, be a friend, tell a friend. Thanks, guys.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. Today, I've got Anna Maria Henao on the show. Welcome to the show, Anna Maria.
Hi, Connor. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here today.
I know. I'm so glad that Igor thought to connect us, and I have way more questions than we'll be able to actually address today, but we're going to do our best to fit it all in.
I'm very happy to be here, and let's see how much we can get today done.
Perfect. I really wanted to start out with something I'm fascinated about, because as I looked at your background, I realized that you got dropped right into the middle of one of the biggest technology revolutions of the last 20 or 30 years, right? Which is artificial intelligence. So ChatGPT got released just a month or two afterwards. Obviously, Microsoft announced partnerships with Bing that integrated AI, which completely changed the product. Again, within a couple of months of you coming in. So I'd love to know what that period was like, knowing that you oversee Bing and just what it's looking like moving forward.
Well, definitely has been a very interesting 6 months, to say the least. As you said, right after I joined Microsoft, it was the announcement of AI. It was the release of ChatGPT as a consumer-facing product. And then ever since, the integration of more AI features into all of our products. It feels like it's a pivotal point for the company, and I will say in general for technology, because the use of AI, I think right now we're just scratching the surface of everything that AI is going to be able to do for us in our personal lives as well as in our professional lives as we seek to be more productive every day. So learning a lot, there is part of the Microsoft culture. We use a lot something called growth mindset. So certainly that growth mindset has been practiced every single day for the last 6 months in an accelerated way to keep up with the change. But what we see is a future where AI is going to play a very significant role in the way how we use our products. So we're definitely very excited for what the future is going to hold for the company as we leverage more and more the use of AI.
What was that period like? Because I have to imagine they kept a lot of those partnerships fairly under wraps. So I'm sure they're like, hey, we're announcing this week. Please put together an initiative. Is that just like every week there's something new coming your way?
Yes. And I would say probably one of the biggest differences versus CPG, I spent 25 years of my career in CPG companies. And the initiatives, big initiatives, transformative initiatives, you have months, if not years, to get ready for it. And you know beforehand that they're coming and you prepare everything, you align the partners, internal and external, and everything is catering towards that moment when finally the initiative is taking place. In the case of AI, we're learning as we go, literally drinking from the fire hose, understanding what we can do, how we can do it, how to communicate, how to improve the experience for the end users. So it has been very different for me to see how such a big and important initiative has been cascade and we have reacted to it. It's very nimble, extremely agile, and one where we just, I would say progress versus perfection probably will be the best way to define it.
I bet. I mean, it was so interesting, especially during that first kind of several months, to see how rapidly things happened within these trillion-dollar companies, right? This is not something, even technology, yes, it moves quickly, but it doesn't tend to move that fast. I would have loved to be a fly on the wall. I think it would have been really fun.
Yeah, definitely. I would say 10 years from today, a good conversation started will be this experience that I've been going through for the last 6 months, along with all the other employees of the company, my peers. We have been all going through this together.
You've been very successful on the CPG side, right? At Pepsi, at P&G before that, at Saab, Miller as well, right? What made you decide after 25 years in CPG to switch industries, to go to something that's totally, obviously it is still consumer facing, but you know, technology is very different, right? What made you decide to do that?
I would say probably three things. The first thing was getting out of my comfort zone. I have been in CPG, or I was in CPG for 25 years with fantastic companies, amazing love brands. But at some point, you start to think like, what will it look like to work for something totally different? So I would say pushing myself to be out of the comfort zone probably was one of the reasons why I started the conversation at Microsoft when they reached out to me and said, oh, this is interesting, it's different. Then the more I had the opportunity to get to know the company, I would say the other two things I was very impressed by was one, the talent, the people that I had the opportunity to interact with through the interviewing process. The caliber of the talent and the quality of the people was for me very, very important, because I am very particular on the way how, for me, values are very important. So I was able to see how that was coming through the people I had the opportunity to interact with through the interviewing process. And I'm very happy to see what I see now that I'm inside. And I would say, last but not least, the purpose of the company. I have worked previously for three companies that were extremely committed to the purpose of making the world a better place and using the platforms for that. And what I see at Microsoft is a true commitment as well to empower people to be the best they can be every day. So the purpose was certainly probably like the bow that wrapped the gift that made me decide this is a great opportunity and I went for it.
You know, what's really interesting about it as well is, like you said, Microsoft reached out to you, which, you know, I'm surprised they too would want to cross vertical boundaries, right? Go into totally new categories and bring people in. It's pretty fascinating. You'd mentioned values there. One of the discussions that I thought was really fascinating was your discussion around curiosity, compassion, and courage on the P&G alumni podcast.
Yes.
Can you describe that philosophy for people? I thought I'm not going to do a good job of summarizing it. I think you did a much better job.
Yes. So it's probably the journey that I have been on through all these years in my career. About 5 years ago, I started reflecting. They always ask you this question about leadership, like what leadership means to you and how you've been able to successfully be a leader. And then I started reflecting on what does it really mean, what I have learned in the last years as I've been through my professional journey. And then I landed on this concept of the three C's. So the first, I would say, for you to be a successful leader today and for the future, there are three concepts that I try to actually apply every single day. So the first C is compassion. And compassion is all about empathy, but the definition of compassion is empathy plus action. And I like that definition a lot, because it's not only about understanding the other side, either be the consumer, the customer, a coworker, someone that works for you. It's not just understanding, but it's what you do with that understanding, how you turn that understanding into action. So I love that concept, because what I have seen is you need to understand, you need to have lots of empathy. But for example, if we talk about consumers and you understand the consumer very well, you know what they want, you know what they need. But then if your decisions are not made on that understanding, but what is convenient for the company, then empathy becomes useless. So that's why I like compassion a lot, because it's understanding is lots of empathy, but it's turning that empathy into action and is championing that understanding and being honest and truth to that understanding so that your actions are honoring those things that you have learned. So the first one is, as I said, compassion. The second one is curiosity. I would say for me, the brain is a muscle that you have to keep on training every day. So it's the conviction really that you're never a finished product. And what you see here, particularly what I have lived in the last 25 years, if I wouldn't have been curious, I wouldn't have been able to make it to where I am right now. And I don't think I will be able to make it to the next 5 years or even the next 6 months. Because if you think about AI, the fact that I joined the company and the AI revolution hit 2 months after, you have to stay curious. You have to keep this open mind. You have to become a lifelong learner to really be successful. Because if you believe that you're an end product, that you have learned it all, then you become very quickly obsolete. So I would say curiosity is very important and is about exercising your brain every single day. I have two teenagers. I have to be curious every day to keep up with them, to understand how they interact with friends, how they see the world. And then I need to keep informing myself so that I can have a good relationship with them. And the same is true in the workplace, because we need to be curious. We're in constant evolution. Nothing is really constant in the world anymore. So we need to be curious and to remain curious all the time. And then the last C is about courage. And the definition of courage that I use is that courage is not the absence of fear, but it's more the conviction that action is more important. Every single time that you're making a decision, you need to be courageous to lean in and to say, okay, I'm going to do something here. And what I have seen is that sometimes in the absence of courage, if you are waiting for the 99.9% certainty of what is going to happen, of all the information that is available, then you start being in a lethargic mode that what's happening is opportunities are just going by. So you need to be informed, right? So you need to be intelligent as to when to lean in. But at certain point, you just need to lean in and face the consequences of your actions. And if it doesn't work, say, okay, at least I'm learning. Because fear is always going to be there. You will never get to a stage where you're like, I'm 100% certain that the results are going to be 100% what I'm expecting. There is always risk. So for me, courage is important, is to know when to pivot, is to know when to say, I know enough, there is risk, but this is sufficient. And then I will lean in and I will just assume the consequences of whatever happens. And I think as far as those consequences, you take it with a growth mindset so that it's constructive. And if you fail, at least you're learning. There's always a gain and way more than if you just stay in pause and do nothing.
One of the areas that I found really challenging is how you encourage that kind of down the chain. And I'd be curious how you do that. This ability to be like, failure is okay, right? Like it's okay to make decisions without perfect certainty. And if it doesn't go all right, that's okay. How do you think about creating that culture internally of like accepting failure, moving fast, operating with impartial information at times? Obviously, that's something you guys are having to do right now, day to day on the AI front. How do you instill that within the organization?
It depends on the impact of what you're doing, right? Certain things you can lean in and the risk is not very high. So you just lean in and you learn. But on big things, what I have done in the past, and it has always worked, is I'm not trying to attack the full immune system. I'm not a true believer of big bangs and changes that are like revolutionary, and because it's too big. There is too much in the immune system that is going to attack the change. And then you will end up just trying to justify or explain or try to bring too many others with you. The way how I have seen change work best for me, at least in my experience, it has been starting small and grow fast. So I think if you just identify like a use case where you feel there is a high chance of success, and you do that well, even if you fail, the learnings on that small cell, let's say that test tube, are so powerful that then you can start growing like a virus. And that is my approach to change, is just take a small piece where you really believe you're going to be successful, do it very well, and then prove your concept. And with that concept proof, then you will start seeing that actually there is demand for change because everyone wants to be part of a winning team. So the moment that you're successful, even if it's in a small environment, people will start looking and saying, oh, I want some of that. Coming to you. So you don't have to fight the immune system. The immune system is coming and saying, I want to join this party. So for me, the approach that has worked best, I would say it has been this approach of a virus. Start small and then spread fast.
I think I need to learn from you. I think my approach, unfortunately, has been the Big Bang, which is like, let's do it. And then I like knowing that I'm going to face significant backlash, right?
Yeah.
I think I need to adopt that approach. You know, how do you get people excited about it and get it so that it's a pull, not a push, right? You're not pushing it on people, but they're pulling it out of you. You're just getting started. But are there any areas within Microsoft, within divisions that you focus on, that you're excited about, like you're starting to see some change really take place? Because obviously you come in, right? You're going to have your own like, hey, oh, I love this, I love this, I love this, but this area can get better, right? What are some of those areas where you feel like you guys can get better?
What I'm really excited about is, well, AI is certainly the revolution of our products and what's ahead. It's a huge chapter of what is very exciting at the moment. But I will say the other one is our CMO, Chris Capozzella. He has been and publicly very committed for us to leapfrog more on what we call brand love. We have fantastic products. The features, the breadth and the depth of our products is immense. And it's very, very competitive. And in many cases is best in class. I would say we're committed to advance more is in brand love and is how we move. We have a better balance on this very functional connection that we have to a more emotional level. So consumers feel excited and they feel that emotional connection and stronger connection with the Microsoft brands. We have brands like Xbox where, I mean, the link and the strength of the bonding with our between the brand and the consumers is very, very high. But in other brands, I would say the strength of the connection is more rooted on the functional benefits that we offer. And we're working more and more towards a better balance of that functional connection with an emotional connection.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fascinating from the outside to just observe kind of the evolution of Microsoft, the brand. I think specifically when I grew up, right, Microsoft was Bill Gates, it was the leading edge, right? And then I think it fell off for a little while. And then over the last, I think, 5 years, 7 years, I think it has come back both as a company, but also just as a brand. I think that it's really recaptured this momentum as being seen as the cutting edge and being something that people are becoming more attached to. How do you do that kind of functionally? So, okay, so that's the mission, right? We want to make people more connected to the brand. What are some of the ways that you actually solve that or do that?
I like a lot the concept of How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp. And
yep.
He talks about the balance between mental availability and physical availability, right? So for a brand to be successful and to grow, you need that balance, right? So mental availability is all about, do I know the brand? Is the brand relevant for me in the moment when I'm going to use the category? And ultimately, is the brand that I would choose? So is that all bonding and let's say irrational connection that you can build with the consumer, but that needs to be paired with what he calls physical availability, which is the brand present in the places where I go to buy? Can I find it? And ultimately, are there enough, is a value proposition attractive enough for me to make the choice to buy that brand? So I will say it's the combination of the two. And it's always that fine balance, right? Because if you have a lot of mental availability, let's say you're going to buy a car. If you ask me like, okay, what are the brands that comes to mind? I will say maybe Ferrari and McLaren and what have you. But the truth is they're out of reach. So you have a lot of mental availability. You might have lots of awareness, but then you're not relevant. In the other end, if you have lots of physical availability, you're present, you're available in all the places where the consumers are going to buy, but ultimately there's no that connection, then you're lacking. So I would say the balance of the two and how you can truly make sure that you have strengths in both is when really the magic happens, because it's the emotional aspect is strong, but also the functional aspect, which justifies the purchase, is as strong. So then, boom, you have that positioning that gives you a competitive advantage versus others.
100%. I think from a mental availability perspective, or at least from a brand connection perspective, obviously we're in the business of social media, influencers, user-generated content. That's really exploded over the last, call it 10 years or so. You know, how are you thinking about that as a channel, right? How do you guys think about investing in that? And from a numbers perspective, it's growing very fast, right? We're tracking the data. You're growing very quickly. You'll still see a gap, like Apple and say Google are getting greater volume, right? So how do you think about that channel? How do you think about investing in it? What is your philosophy with it, et cetera?
I would say I could be very strategic, right? Like, is there numbers that prove that consumers believe influencers more today than what they see on regular advertising or what they can read on a magazine. Even sometimes the recommendation of an expert has less weight than the recommendation of an influencer that they trust.
Yep.
But I would just go with the kitchen logic, right? I have been,
I'm excited to hear this.
I have been, and I am guilty of buying things that I never thought I needed just because I saw someone on Instagram using it. I talk with my friends and they are guilty of the same. So I think it's sometimes, and I go back to curiosity, sometimes it's just the art of observation of how people behave that really gives you the right cues. I would say I am pretty competent on marketing, and I know that they're influencing my mind. Still, I'm using my Apple Pay to buy it. So that is just proof that it works, right? The connection that we're building with influencers is such that we actually believe we know them. I have never seen them, but at some point you start building a relationship and you start feeling that sense of familiarity and you start believing like they are someone very close to you. And then when they say this works, or I'm using this for my kids, or in beauty, for example, is a big category, in fashion, you follow them just because you have believed that relationship of trust, even though you have never met them and probably you will never will. But you like their lifestyle and you feel they're very authentic, and some of them, they don't look as commercial, some others more so. Still, so for me, sometimes yes, look at the numbers, do the, let's say, the more intellectual exercise. But at the end of the day, it's just simple observation of your behavior and the behavior of people that you know. And when you see that that repeats enough, there is something there that is working. And there is definitely worth for you to see how that can be of benefit to the business where you're working.
I always go back to just the question of like, how do people learn about things, right? And how do they make decisions? And I think that that's really what marketing is. At what point are you going to have an effect on how somebody learns about something and like where they go to learn about that thing and make the ultimate decision, right? And so for me, I as well buy plenty of things that I find online. And so I guess the question is, okay, so we believe in it. I mean, there's thousands of influencers that talk about Microsoft and all the subsequent brands of Microsoft, Bing and Xbox, et cetera. How are you as an organization investing in that? Do you have a team that's spending time on it? If they are they gifting products? Are they paying influencers? What kinds of activities are they doing? Obviously, again, business that we're in, I think it's something I'm super curious about.
Yes. I would say first thing you need to do is we have a team that is dedicated to this. A very passionate team, actually, that is dedicated to this. And they have moved the needle quite a lot for the company, I would say, in the last 12 to 24 months. First thing is you need to cover the basics, right? You need to do a due diligence of who this influencer or group of influencers are from the point of view of reach, compatibility with the brand. Do you want to feel associated with them? Is it the right fit? Does the story feel organic within the world that they have created? But also the risk, right? Because at the end of the day, when you start using an influencer, the influencer is the face of your brand. So you kind of need to project what can go wrong. Like, this person can be doing something that is not appropriate or we don't feel very comfortable with. So I would say the due diligence of how compatible is the influencer to your brand and how the two equities can live together in a way that feels natural and organic to the reach. Are we reaching the right audiences? And I would say a risk assessment is also very important. And then is to start building with them stories that feel once again authentic for them. I don't like the stories where you can see clearly that the influencer is being paid. I like the stories where they are truly using or interacting with a product in a way that is part of their natural story. For example, if you have, like I have seen, I don't know, fitness influencers that out of a sudden are doing things that I'm like, what does this have to do with the story, right? Like, there needs to be like a connector.
At least try, guys. At least give it a try.
So those are the stories that I don't like. I don't think it's a matter of gifting the product or paying them. Of course, this is their work.
Yep.
So I recognize that. And as much as I work, they work. And you have to be respectful of that. But at the end of the day, you need to respect their brand as well. And then finding the right way to really create a storyline that makes sense. Sometimes it's funny and it doesn't make sense. And that's why it makes sense. But when I say it makes sense, is that it feels they are who they are. They're not changing their DNA because of you, but rather your product is becoming part of the story in a way that it feels right. That's how we try to approach this space, because otherwise either you're not effective or in the worst case scenario, the consumers will reject and that then end up being a negative impact to your brand.
So I'm going to butcher the quote, but I remember this quote and it was like, you know, a good communicator when they can take something fairly complex and describe it in a really straightforward and simple way. And I think you do a really good job of that. So just just some feedback from me. I've really appreciated that. And 100% agree, right? Like when it doesn't make sense, when it's inauthentic, when it's not in line with who that person is, not only does it hurt them, but it ultimately just doesn't work very well either, right? And so another topic that I think is really interesting, and I'm going to kind of combine two things, right? So one is you mentioned you used to have to create two or three pieces of content a year. Now you have to create two or three a week, right? Or, you know, more than that, hundreds a month. And a lot of that content now is shifting from content you don't even create yourself, but just reusing content from other people, whether it's a consumer or an influencer, et cetera. Have you guys started integrating a significant amount of that content into your other channels, right? Whether it's your website or your ads or your emails, like how do you think about that integration of content that you don't create yourself into your marketing channels? And how do you work with that when it's not always going to be perfectly on brand or perfectly on message?
That's actually a really good question, because when I started this journey 25 years ago, I was at Procter & Gamble and best school for marketing at the time. And it was, I would say, easy compared to what we have to do today, because it was...
Well, if you got it wrong, it was really bad, because you only got like one shot.
It was predictable, right? So it was like baking. Here are the ingredients. These are the amounts. And if you mix it right, you will get the cake. Today, the ingredients are changing. The amounts are different every day. So you have to be more flexible and steer and try to react to what's happening and what's working. Back in the day, I have only one segmentation, and it was demographic, as a little bit of psychographics, and that was it. Today, we have micro segments and the content that works for students. Right now, we're about to implement back to school. And then we're talking to the students and we're talking to the parents and what is working for them. So it becomes way, I would say, more complex, because we have more information and we can personalize way more than what we could do 25 years ago. For me, the big impact of the digitization era has been the democratization of the information. And what that means is that information is available to everyone. And now, as the brand guardians that we are, we share custody of that brand with the millions of users that use our brand every day. And that's a mindset shift that happened in the last 15 years that is very, very important. Because before, we were in control, right? The TV, I will serve you the content and you will take it. And you have no option. And I will interrupt, I don't know, your soap opera or your cartoon or the game that you were watching. And I will interrupt that and I will serve you my ad. And you had no other choice but to watch it. It's very different today. So we're sharing the guardianship or the custody of the brand. And either we like it or not, consumers are going to talk about our brands. And that's where you have to understand that it's not your sharing custody. You have lost a lot of control of the content that is happening out there. So I think the best way for you to do that is, one, to recognize that. Two, to celebrate the fact that there are millions of consumers that are willing to talk about your brand. Consumers that care enough that will write a review, either if it's good or bad, but they care sufficiently to spend 2 minutes or 3 minutes letting you know how it's going. And I think the moment you embrace it, then you start creating value for the brand. I think the moment you try to control or you try to ignore, then it's when you get in trouble. Because I had to deal many times with issues and crises that we had with consumers. And what I have learned through that is when you show you care, consumers will appreciate that. But when you disregard or ignore or be like prepotent and say like you're wrong, I'm right, is when things really go south very quickly. So we celebrate that. I mean, we have to celebrate the fact that people care. We have to celebrate the fact that people create content of good quality or bad quality, but they're spending time with us. That's fantastic. I mean, that's what you want to have. We want to become part of the social conversation. You want to become like an urban legend. You want people to wear a t-shirt that says Microsoft or Xbox or Pepsi in my previous life. And when you see that on the street, you're like, wow, this is fantastic. I mean, people care. The worst place where you can be is in limbo, like when no one cares, because then there is nothing there. When people care, there is passion. I think that's the best place. But for me, is how you embrace that and how you channel that energy to co-create something with consumers that make the brand stronger. For me, I would say that's the underlining idea that I try to use for this.
I love that concept of brand custodian. I don't know why. I'm sure somebody has said it before, but I've never heard it. 70% of what I'm interviewing on here is CMOs. And so this is the first time one of them's mentioned it. And I love that, right? Like you're not in control in the same way you are, right? You're guiding the mission. You're like guiding the community, but there's a community. So I just did a podcast 2 days ago with a woman named Danessa Myricks, who's got over a million fans on Instagram. She's killed it. Self-made brand, growing very, very quickly. Top 50 brand we track. And she's like, yeah, I stress out every night going to bed if I haven't replied to all the comments that night, right? But you think about it from a personal perspective, right? Even somebody that writes something negative, like they care enough to go out and talk about it. And every time somebody does that and they go out and they talk about the brand and they don't hear anything back, right? They don't get any response. It's a really big missed opportunity, right? You feel bad versus alternatively, you go out, you're like, oh my God, I love my new Surface, whatever. I've been using it to do this, that, and the other thing. And then somebody from the Microsoft team reaches out and says, hey, thanks so much for giving us a shout out. Let us know if you ever want to get coffee. Like that's such a meaningful connection for them. Right. And so being able to do that at scale is challenging, but like so powerful when you can. Very cool.
Totally agree.
Well, let's do one more question and then we'll do a fun end of show question. So you seem to be a person, based on my observations, that spends a significant amount of time in self-reflection and even documenting those reflections. So like the three C's being an example of that. Do you have like a formal process for that? Or is this something that, you know, you wake up at night and you write yourself a note and then you just remember it? How do you think about self-reflection and documentation of that?
I love to run and I run regularly. I exercise 6 days a week. And for me, that is my active meditation. And I like to do that because as I am spending an hour or so in the morning exercising, then it's when I have those moments of self-reflection. So I use that time. It's a quiet time. Sometimes I listen a lot to podcasts or audiobooks. And it's that moment when my mind is like totally disconnected from the tasks. And it's really when I have an opportunity to think about what's going on or connect one idea to the other. So I would say having that space and creating that space is very important for me. It wasn't always like that. I have two teenagers when they were little kids. It's harder to do it because you're busy and you have to look after them. But the more I have done it, the more I have realized it's probably the most powerful hour of my day because it's for me. So even when I travel, I sometimes wake up at 3 a.m. and I still make the hour just because I'm committed to it. And it's not because of the physical aspect, but I would say it's more the mental aspect. It gives me the space to think. It gives me the space to create. It gives me the space to clear my mind if that's what I need and to re-energize. So I would say probably that's when most of the reflection happens, is in that morning, active meditation, as they call it, time.
I love that. So my last grandparent just passed away, my grandfather, and he was in his early 90s. So he'd outlived my other grandparents, and he was a really good artist. And I asked him, like, why do you think you live so long? And he said, I exercised every day. And he kind of went on about this story about it. And so I've gotten into a decent routine, but I'm not like that. Like, I don't wake up at 3 a.m. while I'm traveling to work out. So I think I need to do it both for self-reflection and for just, you know, living a long time. I think one of my favorite facts about you is that you went to the National Math Olympics in Colombia, right? Interesting. Yeah. So congrats on that. So I'd love to know, are you still kind of a math nerd? Like, I watch math TikTok videos. Like, is that something you still invest in? Have your kids adopted that as well? Or are they like, no, mom's weird. Like, we don't want to be in the math Olympics.
Yeah. So about that. Two answers. On the first question, I do love math problems, challenges, you know, like, can you solve this in 3 seconds? And I'm like, oh, go for it. I guess it stays with you. I love numbers. I actually use numbers a lot for random things like running. I count up to 100 and I know that 2 minutes have passed while I'm running. And then if it's more like if I want to go faster, then I count faster. So I like numbers. It's just the way how I am. So yes, I still use numbers a lot for fun on a regular basis and of course for work. And no, my kids hate that. They're good at math, but the fact that I went to Math Olympics, they feel lots of pressure. So I'm not even consulted for homework. They don't like to do math homework with me. They do very well in math, but I'm not a resource for them. I guess they feel a lot of pressure.
Oh my gosh. I am so appreciative of the time that you took out today, and it's not surprising to see where you've gotten. And I'm excited to see what you do as you embark on your new career in the technology sector, and applaud your continued growth mindset and desire to learn new things. So thanks again. I'm so glad we got to spend the time.
Oh, Conor, it has been an absolute pleasure for me to be here today. Fantastic conversation. I truly enjoyed this time, and I hope we get to have another conversation soon.
Let's do it. All right. Bye, Anna Maria.
Bye. Thank you.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.